Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. U.S. President Donald Trump interviewing for candidates this Sunday to be his national security advisor after a tumultuous week in which he fired one former military leader from the strategic White House post and his first replacement choice turned the job down. He's spending the weekend at his lavish oceanfront Mar-a-Lago club in Florida. He's planning to discuss the job in person or on the phone with acting National Security Advisor Keith Kellogg, a retired Army General, John Bolton, a former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Army General H.R. McMaster, and the superintendent of the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, General Robert Caslin. The Associated Press is reporting that U.S.-backed Iraqi forces have launched a large-scale military operation today to dislodge Islamic State militants from the western half of Mosul. It is a battle that is expected to be prolonged and difficult to a densely packed civilian population in older, narrower streets. Humanitarian agencies are gearing up to help between 250,000 to 400,000 civilians who may flee. President Trump will soon release a more streamlined version of a presidential order banning immigrants from seven Muslim-majority nations, but Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly says it will be better implemented.
I will have a rollout plan, in particular to make sure that there's no one, in a sense, caught in the system of moving from overseas to our airports, which happened on the first release.
The first executive order dealing with immigration was stopped by the courts. This is VOA News. The UN Syria envoy says he hopes to take advantage of a new momentum during the upcoming round of UN-led talks involving the al-Assad government and rebel representatives this week in Geneva. Stéphane de Mistura said that the outcome of the conversation will essentially depend on the U.S. position. Meanwhile, White House envoy Brett McGurk said he does not think the U.S. will come in with a one-size-fits-all solution because there isn't one.
There's not some tool in the toolkit that, oh, we're just going to look a little harder and find this tool, and suddenly the situation is going to be dramatically improved, especially after 5 years of this horrific civil war. But if you look at the situation now, just trying to calm it down, there might be some opportunities simply because of the de-escalatory cycle that we've seen. But we really would have to reinforce this.
Previous efforts, which have involved indirect negotiations mediated by the UN envoy for Syria, resulted in little progress to resolve a war that began as peaceful protest against the Assad before spiraling into a multi-party conflict. Although no one has yet claimed the responsibility for the blast, Somalia officials are blaming al-Shabaab militants for an attack that killed at least 30 people. Dozens others were wounded when the massive car bomb exploded in a busy market in the capital Mogadishu Sunday. The attack came hours after al-Shabaab denounced Somalia's new president. A senior U.S. Republican senator urged President Trump Sunday to take action against Russia over allegations Moscow interfered in the election that brought him to power. U.S. intelligence officials have told Trump that Moscow tried to influence voters by hacking Democratic emails and trolling social media sites, but Mr. Trump has sought to downplay Russia's role in that election. Speaking to world leaders, diplomats, and defense officials at the Munich Security Conference, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham said Congress needs to get involved to ensure there are consequences for the alleged hacking. The South Korean government says it believes North Korea masterminded the assassination of Kim Jong-nam, the half-brother of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Unification Ministry spokesman made the remarks Sunday in a briefing that was held following Malaysian police's statements on the case from earlier in the day.
앞으로 최종 조사 결과가 나오겠지만 우리 정부는 동 피살자가
So his final investigation results are still to be announced, but South Korean government is certain that the murdered man is Kim Jong-nam. Under various circumstances, and the government perceives North Korea was the mastermind behind the incident, considering that five suspects have North Korean nationality. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Gabriel Droplam, the Minister of Labour, Public Service and Human Resource Development, has just joined the EFOSOT of internet resignation.
Another high-profile South Sudanese official resigns from the government.
Indeed, we begin with the gross law that started when this first term began, and we are escalating it to a strike that will begin on the 20th of February.
Zimbabwean teachers threatening to strike beginning Monday.
It's a pretty much normal message that comes every now and again because registration and voting is voluntary. So we always encourage people to go and register, to exercise their rights.
And Swaziland's King Eswati III calls on citizens to vote in next year's elections. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. South Sudanese Labour and Public Service Minister General Gabriel Droplam has resigned, pledging he would support former Affairs Vice President Dr. Riek Machar. He cited inconsistency in President Salva Kiir's leadership as one of his major reasons to leave the administration. His resignation comes as two top military officials also resigned, saying they are displeased with President Kiir's government and his leadership. For reaction, I reached Ateni Wekateni, spokesman for President Kiir in the South Sudanese capital, Juba.
What I wanted to say here is that Gabriel Droplam, the Minister of Labour, Public Service and Human Resource Development, has just joined the EFOSOT of internet resignation, simply because it's not because he had anything, that he sees wrong in the government, but because the government nowadays has no much money, as most of these people expect to get money when they are in government. So he decided to join the rebellion of Riek Machar. And it is very simple. It has nothing to do with being principled, or has nothing to do with anything to do with the failure of government of South Sudan. It's about him trying to search for a better place. He was a warlord, and therefore a government that has no money, he cannot tolerate that.
But Ateni, obviously the government has more money than the rebels who scavenge and whose finances could be sanctioned by the international community. Obviously, you are not saying that the rebels have more money than the government, if that is how you put it.
No. The truth of the matter is this. He cited frustration. From who? The government of South Sudan is intact, is doing its best. Droplam, the first time he came together with Dr. Riek, he was put as a deputy minister in the Ministry of Interior. But Taban Dengai, on acceding to the position of first vice president, immediately made Gabriel Droplam as the Minister of Labour, Public Service. But because of incompetence of this person, he has never worked in government before, he could not know what to do in that ministry. And so even last time he came to the State House, he was complaining about the fact that, he has not been given a new car. So the man is frustrated by some things that he wanted for himself.
If he didn't know what to do, why didn't the president fire him if he is incompetent? And two, some are saying that his resignation follows a recent high-profile resignation as well of a high-profile military officer. Some people are saying that it's a signal that they don't repose confidence in the ability of President Salva Kiir to deliver to the people of South Sudan.
This is absolutely nonsensical, given that there is no episode of resignation. These are just, rubbish, because the other officer who said, his name is Khalid Onoloki, who said he was resigning from military courts, as he was not having any position to resign from. He was, by then, a normal person. He did not have a job to resign from. And when coming back to the issue of Gabriel Droplam, why the president actually appointed him and he was not competent, the man was the head of the White Army. So he was a serious warlord. And by virtue of the fact that he's part of the SPLM-SPLA-IO, he was recommended to have a ministerial position so that, you know, you buy peace. Otherwise, if you don't do that, he will return back and, you know, and start fighting.
Attorney, both of these high-profile officials, one in the army and then this one, the Minister of Labor, have said one thing in common, that President Salva Kiir seemed not to have a clue about really administering the affairs of the country to, one, give the people peace and improve the living conditions of South Sudanese.
How can President Salva Kiir alone improve the livelihood of the people of South Sudan when, in actual fact, you know, such behaviors that actually are actually in there, within the mind of the caliber of Gabriel Duop Lam and Thomas Cirillo, is that, you know, of installing the pockets of rebellions all around South Sudan that is care of all the investors to come to South Sudan. So where do South Sudan get money? And where do President Salva Kiir get money? What they are actually saying, which is thought to be in common, is the sheer ignorance about what the leadership is all about. Because if they are not ignorant, they were part of the leadership of the government of transitional national government of national unity.
Attorney Wekatene is the spokesman for South Sudanese President Salva Kiir. He spoke with me from Juba. Meanwhile, the South Sudanese government says it wants to restart oil production at 6 oil facilities in the former unity state, where production was halted because of ongoing fighting. Government spokesman Michael Makue says the National Army or the SPLA will deploy more soldiers in the area to secure the facilities and protect workers. For VOA, Michael Atit has the story from the South Sudanese capital, Juba.
Makue told reporters after today's cabinet meeting in Juba that the government has directed Petroleum Minister Ezekiel Lul Garkweth to start production at 6 oil fields in the former unity state. Makue says the government is now asking all the companies that left during the violence to return and resume the production.
They stopped production due to the crisis, and now efforts are underway for this field to resume production. And before they could resume production, the companies which were there had given certain conditions to the ministry so that they are enabled to start the production.
Makwei acknowledges that some of the conditions demanded by the companies for resuming production have not been met. He did not elaborate. Makwei says the government will deploy more troops to the area, but did not mention how many.
The security sector organs have been directed to deploy additional forces in the oil fields for the protection of the oil. Then, according to the established system of the protection of the oil fields, there are three layers of protection which are usually put in place. The outer layer is the army, the second layer is the national security, and the third layer inside is the police.
Last month, the South Sudan government signed a 5-year agreement with China National Petroleum Corporation and Petronas of Malaysia to increase oil production. The deal requires the two companies to significantly increase crude oil exports. Makwei says once the oil fields are secured and oil production resumes, the economy should improve.
The oil companies who do feel insecure, they are made to feel that they are secure so that they continue with the production of the oil for the improvement of our conditions and our security situation.
Up to 98% of the government's revenue comes from oil production. South Sudan produces about 130,000 barrels a day. That is down from more than 300,000 barrels per day in 2011 after South Sudan gained its independence. In September, Petroleum Ministry officials vote to increase oil production to 200,000 barrels per day, but that has yet to happen. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
Striking Zimbabwean junior doctors have again called on the government to improve their living conditions. Teachers are also threatening to strike beginning Monday. For VOA, Kutsai Vinavashi has the report from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Junior doctors in public hospitals have been on strike since Wednesday 15th. Hospitals Doctors Association President Dr. Edgar Munatsi explains why they walked off the job.
There are quite a number of issues, but the main three issues that have been raised with the authorities was the issue of employment post internship, the issue of increment on core allowances for doctors, and provision of subsidized duty-free or vehicles. Doctors want to buy their own vehicles, but they want the government to subsidize in terms of payment.
Munatsi says the issues being raised by the doctors are not new to the government.
These issues are such so because they were agreed upon in 2014 when doctors went on strike. The government agreed to work on these issues and gradually increase the on-call allowance to an hourly rate of $10 per hour. Nothing has been done to that effect. This is the reason why people are then saying this time around we want them to resolve these issues before we can resume our normal duties.
Meanwhile, civil servants have not been paid their annual bonuses from last year, and teachers have been threatening a strike beginning this Monday. Amalgamated Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe President Obed Masara Ure sheds more light on the subject.
Indeed, we began with the God's law that started when this first term began, and we are escalating it to a strike that will begin on the 20th of February. We are happy that the teachers on the ground joined the God's law, and they are more than ready to join the national strike, which will begin on the 20th of February.
Masara Ure says, despite strike plans, support from other associations is not certain.
We are worried that some unions are choosing not to join, but obviously we understand that they are not saving the interests of the workers. They are saving the interests of the employer.
The government has struggled to pay civil servants their bonuses, but has promised to give land instead of cash. Masara Ure says this is an insult.
Land is a right, and for one to claim that they can give us land as a bonus is an insult to the civil servants of this country. And the government must never claim that they can give us land as a bonus. We will reject that, but we still expect the land, but we demand a token of appreciation of the hard work that we are doing for the country.
Munatsi says the issue of bonuses is a topic of discussion for another day.
We have gotten our bonus. Salaries are coming very erratic. There are no fixed dates in terms of salaries. But these are not the issues that we're talking about right now. What we're talking about right now is an increment in terms of on-call allowance.
Munatsi adds talks between the government and doctors are underway, and they will only return to work after the agreement is reached and implemented. The government of Zimbabwe has threatened to sack the doctors on strike, but Munatsi says they have since been reassured that no one will be dismissed. The reason behind the strike is not new, as the government had promised to address all the demands after a strike in 2014, but nothing was implemented till date, hence pushing doctors to down their tools once more. Civil service in Zimbabwe gobbles over 80% of the annual national budget, and the government has been working to cut down its workforce in a bid to attract investment into the country. The government is yet to give the date for delivering bonuses, which is what teachers are demanding. Strikes in Zimbabwe had decreased since the economic and political turmoil of 2008. But observers say in today's declining economy, these developments could indicate that the country is sliding back towards more confrontation between workers and the government. This is Kudzai Zunawashe, reporting for Voice of America from Harare.
Swaziland's King Eswati III has urged citizens to vote in next year's national election. The king says Swazis who fail to vote in the election will hurt the kingdom, since he says they would be abandoning their basic right to choose their own leader. But opposition and civil society groups say the king's pronouncement is inconsistent with the constitution, since political parties are not allowed to participate in any elections in the Southern African Kingdom. The group said the king and government officials keep resisting demands for more democratic reforms that would allow for free multi-party democracy. For reaction regarding the election, I reached Prince Gija Dlamini, chairman of the Swaziland Elections and Boundaries Commission.
It's a pretty much normal message that comes every now and again, because registration and voting is voluntary. So we always encourage people to go and register, to exercise their rights, so that at the end, they feel they've participated in the running government. They have voted in their own choice of people to go and lead the government. So, because every 5 years, Swaziland goes into the polls, into election, to to actually vote and put in new members or put in new people who will be running the government.
Prince Gija, the king in your message is supposed to have said that any Swazis who fails to register to vote for the 2018 national election is abandoning his or her basic right of choosing their own leader, thus hurting the whole kingdom in the process because this will be silencing their own voice. Why are some people still saying that there still appears to be voter apathy in the kingdom?
People have got, they view things in their own way. I can give a straight answer to that. Voter apathy, I think, is everywhere, but not that much strong in Swaziland. But we are trying to make sure that everybody participates, exercise your right, so that at the end, nobody will say, I think the government is not doing well because maybe it wasn't voted by the right people. So we are encouraging everybody to participate. That's where peace and stability will actually sustain when everybody takes part in exercising their rights.
What will be different in the organization of the elections next year from the standpoint of the Electoral Commission, of which you are the chairman?
I don't expect anything to come different. We are still running a government that is being voted in by the same democracy the people of Southern have chosen to adhere to, and we are expecting them to come in numbers, to actually vote and put in people of their choice. Because in Swaziland, we don't vote for a group. It doesn't matter which party you belong to or which denomination or class. Or people who will vote for somebody who got direct to parliament, people who will represent the people who voted for him in his constituency. So there isn't anything different we're expecting in the next coming election.
I'm talking about in terms of the organization of the election, because some people have said, your critics have said, that it is not transparent enough and that political parties are barred from participating in the election. And that is why they said it's not transparent enough. So they expect more transparency and perhaps for political parties to be allowed to participate in the elections.
Transparency, to my belief, to the people of Southern belief, is 100% active, 100% there. But it is the people of Swaziland who said, yes, we understand about multi-parties. We have seen it in our neighboring countries. We have seen it what's happening in other countries. But we still are not ready for multi-partism as a small country. But whichever group you belong to, nobody is stopping you from going to parliament. But you cannot go to parliament on the cover of a name. It is your integrity. People will have to vote for you, regardless of whether you belong to whatever religion or class in life or party. But you, your integrity will put into parliament. They want to believe in you, not the name or the club name behind you. That's how nothing will change. People are still sticking to that.
Prince Gija, you just made a statement. I wanted a clarification. You said Swaziland are not ready yet for multi-party democracy as in other regions. Is there an empirical proof to that? And do you have an overwhelming support from the Swazi population who are backing your stance that they are not ready for multi-party democracy?
Yes, thank you for bringing that up. I didn't make that statement, but I relate it. That statement was made by the people of Swaziland when people were saying there are multi-parties. We have got people who are interested in multi-partism in the country. And His Majesty opened it to everybody. He set a commission of inquiry throughout the whole country, like a referendum, you know, type. How do you want to be ruled? Do you want multi-parties? And the overall answer came out 3 times. We are not yet ready for that.
Prince Gija Dlamini is the chairman of the Swaziland Elections and Boundaries Commission. He spoke with me from the capital, Mbabane. Late last year, the International Olympic Committee announced that climbing will be an event for the first time at the 2020 Tokyo Olympics. In the sport, athletes tackle walls of various heights and complexities to reach the top as fast as possible. An indication of the growth of indoor climbing in South Africa is that its under-19 team placed 32nd out of 15 national teams at the Youth World Championships in China in November last year. Not bad for a country that only started competing globally a few years ago. Many of the nation's climbers from the ages of 5 to late 60s are training at the City Rock Complex in Johannesburg. It's Africa's first international class climbing gym and one of the biggest in the world. In the third part of a series on alternative pursuits happening in South Africa, for VOA, Darren Taylor reports.
A young woman struggles up a high wall inside the City Rock gym. The colours of the athlete's outfits match those of the concrete. Royal blue, fire engine red, and mustard yellow. Everywhere there are people grunting and wheezing up ropes, trying to grab the grips to pull themselves to the summit. They use specialised equipment like climbing shoes.
They have a nice reinforced toe with a sticky rubber that allows you to get good surface tension on your toes.
Spider-Man,
exactly. And then obviously a harness if you're going to be doing the high wall problems. So the harness you tie in with a rope and you have a belay partner who's feeding the rope through a device to make sure you don't come crashing to the ground.
City Rock manager Kelly Bishop explains that belaying secures someone on a rope. A partner maintains tension on it. So if the climber slips, there's a safety measure in place.
So you don't actually fall, you just hang, and then obviously they lower you back down to the ground at a controlled speed. When you're climbing, you actually do better the more calm and controlled you are, and moving slowly and making sure you're safe the whole time, the chance for injury is almost zero.
And when you pull your rope, you get a figure of eight. That's your first basic.
One of Bishop's instructors shows a beginner the ropes. Literally, the trainers teach non-slip knots and how to put a safety harness on. Bishop says climbing makes people very fit because it combines strength and endurance, adding muscle but not bulk.
Because you're basically fighting gravity the whole way up, you will build to your natural body shape. It's a full body workout. You're using your fingertips, your toes, your core muscle, your upper body, even your brain, because you're problem solving as you're going. How should I move my hands, etc.
Bishop describes climbing as a lifestyle choice practiced by a wide range of people.
We got doctors, we got lawyers, there's lots of students and school kids. Because it's so social, besides the fitness side, it's a lot of fun. You get to meet really down-to-earth people and feel part of a community.
One of them is vegan baker Pixie Fanek. She describes climbers as a special breed.
They're not to run-of-the-mill people. They're generally a little bit more aware about what's happening in the world environmentally and such. So they're much more inclined to be open-minded.
Bishop says climbing's popular with women.
Women do really well because it's not a brute strength sport. Some of the top climbers internationally are women, and you can compete with the guys head-to-head. It's not about how much weight you can pick up.
As hectic as it looks and sounds in the gym, yoga teacher Neon Nhlapo says climbing helps her to meditate.
My heart rate tends to lower unless I'm going through some ledge fever, which is like an unexpected panic attack on the wall. But usually you don't have the room to think about anything else when you are on a wall. You're really in the moment and you're really focused.
But Nhlapo wasn't always so composed. She describes her first outdoor cliff climb as terrifying.
I was climbing 1 minute and then I just burst into tears the next. And I think the episode lasted a good solid 15 minutes because I was like, if there is a God, God, I'll behave. Just get me off this thing.
Van Eck's battling autoimmune disease, where the body's immune system attacks healthy cells. This could lead to a variety of potentially fatal conditions, including organ failure.
I can't tell you how sick I was last year. I was in hospital. I was having an operation. I thought my life was just this big blob. Boom, I started climbing. I am a million times better. It's amazing. The only thing that saved me was climbing. I got on the wall and I was like, I'm home.
Van Eck says climbing strengthens her body and mind to fight her illness. From being overweight and bedridden, she now conquers nature's steep, jagged rock faces. Across South Africa, people like Van Eck are using climbing gyms to boost their physical and mental health. with some using them as launch pads to possible Olympic glory. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. South Africa's Mamelodi Sundowns won the Africa Super Cup on Saturday. The South African club totally dominated TP Mazembe of the Democratic Republic of Congo in Pretoria, but needed a late penalty to take the trophy. Brazilian centre-back Ricardo Nascimento scored the only goal in the 83rd minute, hand Sundowns a first-ever success in the Super Cup, being played for the 25th time. Mazembe's goalkeeper Sylvaine Bahu stood between Sundowns and a runaway score as the home side ran riot with possession and chances but were unable to find the net. The TP Mazembe's Ivorian goalkeeper pulled off a string of good saves to frustrate Mamelodi Sundowns. The breakthrough finally came in the 83rd minute when Sundowns got a penalty for a wild challenge by Isman Peck on Kakena just when the home captain looked to have lost the ball. Nascimento stepped up and sent Bahu the wrong way and finally gave Sundowns the lead they deserved. Meanwhile, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, has announced that its president, Issa Hayatou, will have a contender when the elections are held on March 16th. His only contender is the president of the Malagasy Football Federation, Ahmed Ahmed, whose country, Madagascar, was coincidentally stripped of the hosting right for the 2017 Under-17 Nations Cup the other week. It will be recalled that CAF, under the supervision of Hayatou, changed its bylaws in September last year, stating that the maximum number of terms in office for any president will now be limited to 3. It, however, added that the new law will not take effect until after the 2017 election and does not prevent Hayatou from running again. If re-elected, Hayatou, now 70, will remain in office until 2021. The Council of Southern African Football Associations, COSAFA, unanimously endorsed Ahmed Ahmed as the presidential candidate in upcoming elections following a meeting of FA presidents in Johannesburg last Saturday. Issa Hayatou, who has presided over African football since 1988, is seeking an 8th term. And the president of the Federation of International Football Association, FIFA, Gianni Infantino, will make a 2-day visit to Uganda. Infantino, who was elected to office in 2016, has embarked on meeting FIFA member associations around the globe to share ideas on football development projects. It will be the first time a FIFA president makes an official trip to Uganda. The 47-year-old, who will be the country February 25th and 26th, has developed a particular fondness for African football, having flown to South Sudan on his first working trip as the head of the world's most popular game. It's expected that Infantino will lay the foundation stone for the FUFA Kadiba Ground Project. The project will be funded under the FIFA Forward Project, where FUFA will receive $5 million over 4 years from the world governing body. That's according to the Uganda FA. Late last week, Gianni Infantino also announced that he'll visit Zimbabwe on his way to Uganda. Zimbabwe is a member of COSAFA, a region that encompasses Madagascar, whose FA head, Ahmed Ahmed, is the sole challenger to Issa Hayatou in next month's CAF presidential elections. The Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, will host the CAF elections on March 16th. Finally, in celebration of Ghana's 60th independence anniversary, Streetwise Promotions, in association with Aerohawk Sports Management, present a 3 WBC international title fights on Saturday, March 11th, at the newly built Bukom Boxing Arena in the capital city of Ghana. In the main event, lightweight world title challenger Richard Comey will battle Belgian Heidi Slimani in the 12-round main event for the WBC International Silver Lightweight title. Co-featured on the same night, Frederick General Okunka Lawson will face off against Jamaica's Sakima Marlins in the scheduled 12-rounder for the WBC International Silver Welterweight title. Running off the headlining bout on the outstanding card, undefeated and world-ranked bantamweight prospect Duke the Babyface Terminator Mika will clash with El Fenix Aguilar of Chiapas, Mexico, in a 12-round bout for the WBC International Silver Tournament title. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Hallelujah. Baby, you turn down the soda. You swagging, shaking your shoulder. And you know, I enjoy your presence, you know. You know, ay, 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 ay. Oba one in Funesanyu. Oba one in Zida Maziga. Oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah.
Baby, Kea. Baby super, nasitima ye guanjakira. Baby kaya, baby super, waka bintu ni lingala.
Runja chire nku, gunda nga kapiro. Mtana miro miro, nange miro miro. Runja chire nku, gunda nga kapiro. Mtana miro miro, nange miro miro. Oh yeah, 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 my baby you take me so high. Soldier, you're my woman song, guitar in the winter.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America.
Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. It is puzzling why those who have been appointed to assist the people of South Sudan to get out of the present difficulties have got things so wrong. You may recall that problem arose between President Salva Kiir and his Vice President Riek Machar. The agreement that was signed or were prepared by IGAD, the regional group in East Africa, tried to bring them together in the 1215 agreement. President Salva Kiir was very, very reluctant to sign the agreement. He made many reservations, but under severe pressure from the African Union, IGAD, and the international community, he reluctantly signed it. Riek Machar came to Juba, and it was hoped that they would work together. But soon after, trouble began. Riek Machar was chased out of Sudan, and he landed up in eastern Congo and later moved on to Khartoum for medical attention due to injuries suffered in the fighting. From Sudan, he went to South Africa, and in December, word spread that Riek Machar was in a sense under house or hospital arrest. But then things start to become more confused. We must also remember that a U.S. representative earlier had suggested that for peace to be preserved in the South Sudan, Riek Machar must be set aside. This was the typical quick fix solutions which are never stable, because the real issue in South Sudan is not only the rivalry between President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar, but a titanic struggle between two major rival groups for supremacy in South Sudan. Then something else happened which was surprising, because the monitoring group, which was supposed to assist in the implementation of the 2015 agreement, began to take sides. The chairman, former president of Botswana, Christoph Mungai, suggested that Mr. Machar should not go to South Sudan until the time of election. There was a pushback from the government, and now he has come with another argument which is very difficult to understand. He has suggested that all those that have rebelled against the government of President Salva Kiir should return to Juba, ask for pardon, and in a sense surrender. But this will not solve the basic problem of South Sudan. So then why are these issues being made? And at the same time we are hearing these suggestions, the United Nations humanitarian community is saying that more than 1.5 million refugees are flowed out of South Sudan to neighboring countries, and alarms are being made. We are also hearing of more fighting in South Sudan, even though the government and its representatives are saying everything is fine. We are also hearing about defections from the government of President Salva Kiir to the Riek Machar group. Now, if we are going to have peace in South Sudan, and we know that Riek Machar has a great deal of loyalty, how is it possible to come to a peaceful agreement if the man who had signed the agreement 1215 is nowhere to be seen in and around South Sudan? Then this is the time for rethinking and to realize that peace can only be achieved if there is a reconciliation between the faction of President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar. The African Union must return to the negotiations and to use its influence to ensure that this is done properly. At the same time, the African Union and other regional groups must be very careful when they select mediators. The fact that somebody was an ex-president is not a guarantee that he or she could be a good negotiator. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, the ever-friendly Michael Dubinsky. We say thanks for joining us, and remember, as the elders say, the chicken says she cries to let the public know her condition, not that her enemy will release her. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. This is one of a series on the U.S. Constitution and the structure of the U.S. government.
To protect individual rights, the framers of the United States Constitution added 10 amendments to the document, which came into force in 1792, 3 years after the Constitution itself did. These amendments are collectively named the Bill of Rights. Arguably, the First Amendment is also the most important to the maintenance of a democratic government. It states that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. The first part of that statement reflects the framers' experience with the long history of religious strife in Europe. They realized that religious discord can be explosive and cause tremendous disruption in politics. It would be doubly so if one religious sect were favored over all others. So they argued that the federal government cannot interfere in the citizens' practice of their religion. The freedoms of speech, press, assembly, and the right to petition the government and seek redress of grievances proclaim that citizens have the right to call the government to account. Freedom of speech and press allows citizens to communicate their ideas verbally and in writing, while freedom of assembly lets them publicly express a common interest. The right to petition allows citizens to point out to the government where it did not follow the law, to seek changes as well as damages for such missteps. Of course, there are limits to these freedoms. One may not force the tenets of his or her religion on those who do not observe those beliefs. Harmful speech, such as yelling fire in a crowded room, is not protected, nor is a written lie that causes harm. As well, gatherings must be peaceful. Destruction of the property of others is not protected by the First Amendment. Liberty is to faction, political parties or movements, what air is to fire, an aliment without which it instantly expires, said James Madison, the principal framer of the Constitution. But it could not be less folly to abolish liberty, which is essential to political life, because it nourishes faction, than it would be to wish the annihilation of air, which is essential to animal life, because it imparts to fire its destructive agency.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.